making TV special.
Venice. Made with creamy butter.
And you know what that means?
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another special interview episode from MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show Media Monarchy. Coming to you on August 6th, 2009, time zones be damned. We're on the line with Albert Lanier, and we're going to talk about the crisis that we see in journalism, but we're also going to look at the bright side and get into the new alternative media and so much more. Albert Lanier, freelance writer and journalist, dozens of newspapers all up and down the West Coast, Hawaii, Washington, California. Thanks for taking the time, man. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me on Media Monarchy. I guess this makes me part of the media aristocracy.
Exactly.
And I guess that would make you... Yeah, I guess it would make you the king of all new media, perhaps.
I would twinge from any, you know, Howard right. Stern comparisons, but...
Right.
So I first heard you and heard of you when mm-hmm. you were on the Corbett Report recently with James Corbett, and that's how you and I got in touch.
Right.
And we're...
As Ed McMahon would have said years... Late Ed McMahon would have said years ago, you are correct, sir.
Yes. And we just recently lost him.
That's right.
So we're swimming in the new alternative media right now as I talk to you through my
computer.
That's
not the only thing we're swimming in. Yeah, we're not the only thing we're swimming in with some of these news stories, but keep going.
Well, if you want to just give a brief background and bio and perhaps mm-hmm. how we've come to be talking today about the new media.
Well, what I'll get into is, of course, what I consider my critique/analysis, what is my critique/analysis, called The Crisis of Journalism. And that title derives from a 1975 white paper written by Samuel Huntington, who, of course, is a political scientist or historian. For those of you who are into books about policy, books about history, he came up with the Clash of Civilizations.
Okay, that's what I was about to say. Clash of Civilizations, right?
Correct. Which was popular after 9/11. So basically what I'll be getting into is, again, my critique/analysis of the crisis of journalism, because what we see going on in the world of journalism, primarily the mainstream media, MSM as alternative websites, alternative news, or as other people would like to put it, is a crisis. Another line that I use comes from the book The Shock Doctrine, written by Naomi Klein. That book, of course, deals with what she calls disaster capitalism. That is the imposition of a neoliberal free market economy in places like Chile after the overthrow of Salvador Allende in September 11th of 1973. And also in the U.S. in places like New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. So what I call it is disaster journalism. She says disaster capitalism. I call it disaster journalism. One, because it literally, journalism in this country is literally a disaster, but also because it's the imposition over the past several years, after actually more than a decade, of what I consider to be disastrous corporate policies and disastrous economic policies relating to the news media and the mainstream media in general. So that's what I'm going to get into. I will also get into the new alternative media, which is another term that I use. Now, how is this different from alternative media? Well, alternative media is what you would call a lot of the left-wing or even some right-wing publications that are not part of the mainstream media. Z Magazine on the left, for example. Over the years, you've seen alternative newspapers, what one might call underground newspapers, alternative magazines, you know, community-supported radio stations.
It could even be, you know, things like zines, and it almost pops into my head, even some of the underground
right.
comics that were...
Absolutely,
that were
if they have a political... Or,
exactly.
Yeah, if they have a political or a news-oriented bias to them or a position. So that's what we're going to get into, is this new alternative media. And this new alternative media uses the Internet as the hub. We're talking radio shows like Media Monarchy. websites like Media Monarchy. We're talking podcasts like Media Monarchy. and in fact, I believe I'm on Media Monarchy. So this is what we see, the internet as the hub of this new alternative media. So that's what I'll be getting into on this episode of, appropriately enough, Media Monarchy.
Absolutely. And, you know, and that's the thing. It's the internet that has enabled this
right.
kind of thing to happen. Even
right,
before
absolutely.
I started to do the website and become interested in, you know, what I say, news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups.
Correct.
I used to just kind of muck around on the web, and it was fun to play Flash games and, you know,
right.
do those sorts of things. But this has really become the kind of purpose for it, at least for me,
right.
and I know I'm not alone.
Right. You are not alone. That's very important, and that's not something out of Close Encounters of the Third Kind or something out of the X-Files. Actually, when it comes to the mainstream media, I kind of feel like the opposite of Mulder. I don't want to believe. That's the problem. But when we, you talked about mucking around, so I gather that you become a muckraker of sorts.
Well, I think I was using it in the bad way first, of mucking around as in just
right.
puttering around
but
and not
muckraking
doing anything.
Is a honorable profession. See, what we have here in the media nowadays is not muckraking, it's gunk raking, is junk raking. That's precisely what they're up to. And of course, we'll be getting into this. The importance of the internet is that it is the freest place on the planet when it comes to news, when it comes to the dissemination of news, when it comes to information, when it comes to contextualization. That's very important. We'll be getting into that. But first, there are a number of, obviously, news topics, news events that have come up. So I know you, I understand you want to address some of those, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I know we recently had Dan Rather coming out and talking about, and this, I just pull it up right now, from Business and Media Institute. Dan Rather calls for White House to save journalism from financial hardship. Former anchor once commissioned on saving journalism jobs and creating new business models. And I've seen it said, it's like, oh, sounds like somebody's vying for the... for a media czar spot.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is interesting coming from the one and only Hurricane Dan. That's what he used to be called because he used to chase hurricanes and cover hurricanes. Dan Rather is a joke. Let's be honest. Dan Rather, come on. He gave a speech recently where he talked about how the corporate media is controlled by six companies, and it's corporations that determine, you know, the way news is disseminated and people are informed. No, really, Dan? You're just figuring this out? You're working for CBS for over 20 years. You're the anchor. You're the one who replaced Walter Cronkite, the most trusted man in America. And while you're at CBS, you were the most untrustworthy man in America. You know why? Because he was biased. That's why. Now, he was against the Bush family, basically. You know, he had that clash with H.W. Bush in the 80s when he interviewed him.
Mm-hmm. That was one of his instances of dead air, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And,
well, I was going to say, I know for me it's also interesting that Dan Rather was one of the first to report that JFK had been shot and was one of the first journalists and anybody to see the Zapruder film for a very, very long time. So I find, you know, and of course now Dan Rather talking about the mainstream media, he was at the very heart of it.
Absolutely. When you are the, basically the voice of news for the Tiffany Network, which is CBS, Columbia Broadcasting System, he replaced Dan Rather. Dan Rather. Well, actually, Katie Couric replaced Dan Rather.
Oh, yeah.
That would be a neat trick if Dan Rather replaced Dan Rather. So we'd have Hurricane Dan, and I guess it would be
Uncle
the
Walter.
Brand new and improved Dan. I don't know. But anyway, Dan Rather replaced Walter Cronkite. And Walter Cronkite, of course, was considered the most trusted man in America. Dan Rather is the most untrustworthy man in America. Let's be honest. Because of his bias against the Bush family. And I'm not saying the Bushes are, you know, people not worth hating. You know, I'm not saying that. But he let his dislike of the Bushes get in the way of his professional integrity. you know. I mean, he allowed it to get in the way of his work.
Ties in with his Air National Guard papers and the story that CBS ran and that whole controversy.
Absolutely. He knew that was BS. He knew it. He could say whatever he wants. He knew that story was just utter nonsense, you know, and he still went after it. And, you know, the guy is a joke. That's what he is. He's a joke. So now he says, oh, well, the media is influenced unduly by corporations. And we have six companies that are basically own most of the media in this country. Yeah, how long did it take for you to figure this out, Dad? Didn't you read The Media Monopoly by Ben Batikian? What, that wasn't on your to-do list? That wasn't part of your reading list? Part of your doer's profile in some magazine or something? Yeah, I mean, you know, Dan Rather is a hypocrite. That's what he is. You know, this is a man who's anti-Bush, and yet after 9/11 he says, oh, line me up, I'll do whatever it takes, you know, to help America or to help you, Mr. President. Well, the man's pathetic. You know, he had a clear bias against the Bush family. Say what you want about, I'm not defending George W. Bush. Trust me, I'm the last person to do that. But the Bushes had a point. You know, the guy was clearly biased. He was not professional. He was not professional. And say what you want about, you know, Brokaw and Jennings on NBC and ABC. They at least acted in a fairly professional manner as anchors. We cannot say the same thing about Dan Rather. So Dan Rather, for him to come out and talk about the government getting involved in saving newspapers, I mean, what do they want? Another Nixon administration support mechanism like happened in 1969 when several newspaper chains went to Richard Nixon and said, look, we'll support you, we'll back you basically if you support this Newspaper Preservation Act. And that's what happened. He basically supported the Newspaper Preservation Act, which passed Congress.
I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, and the chains basically, you know, they basically cut him slack. You know, so maybe he wants something like that. You know,
but
Dan Rather is just...
That this now kind of ties in with the talk of the return of what's called perhaps the fairness doctrine?
Interesting. Well, I'll get into the fairness doctrine, not in terms of the fairness doctrine itself entirely, but as a, what I call the fairness doctrine model in my construct of the critique and slash analysis of the crisis of journalism. But the fairness doctrine basically is being used as a weapon by the Democrats. What they want to do is target right-wing radio, which is talk radio. And let's be honest, talk radio is basically right-wing garbage.
For the most part. And I've seen, too, that, you know, the dirty secret of all that high, you know, listenership of, you know, right-wing talk radio is that it's a lot of older folks.
Very interesting point. Yeah, very interesting point. And even people who don't like right-wingers will listen to a lot of these right-wing shows. I remember years ago in Hawaii, I used to call in on radio shows. Sometimes you'd hang out at some of these radio shows. There's a radio station not far from where I live. And I used to hang out sometimes, a new couple of the hosts. And there's this woman who used to come in, and she had an accent. She was a liberal, and she used to say she couldn't stand Rush Limbaugh. But then she opened a choice just to preface this by saying, have you heard what Rush Limbaugh has said?
That she would always stay tuned for the next thing to get outraged about.
Right. It reminds me of the movie Private Parts. I don't know if you've seen that movie, but
I have.
There's a scene in Private Parts where there's a consultant talking to, I guess it would be the program director, and he says, the people, you know, they're going over data from a survey or a study that was filed about the Howard Stern show, which was on WNBC, as he used to say. But the point that was made was people who like him listen to him. People who don't like him listen to him. And that's a part of the radio phenomena. People who don't like right-wingers still listen. Maybe not in large numbers like the right-wing stooges that become guests, the the ditto heads for Rush Limbaugh. But that's what you see with this sort of right-wing garbage, you know, right-wing talk radio. That's what you see, is that people who don't agree with it often listen. Maybe not all the time, but they listen on a consistent enough basis to find out what's going on.
I think for me, it shines a light on what something I try and hit a lot on the site and show is this sort of kind of fake left and right setup. And so you'll listen to the right-wing radio even though you're left-leaning because it gets you agitated and it gets you something to be rabbled about and you're on the talking points.
Right.
And it keeps people in this, you know, left and right. But what I think we've seen, and I'm sure what we'll get into, is that the new alternative media is kind of breaking that down. And so is this why we see the big mainstream media now lashing out and talking about charging for content and suing for this, and it's turning into a battleground.
Right. That's the whole Internet 2, net neutrality issue, where what the Internet has become, again, it's the hub for what I call the new alternative media. For the first time, we'll get into this later, what there is a real choice. And the corporate powers that be don't want this real choice. They want to kill it. They want to stifle it. They want to destroy it if they can. So what they want to do is they want to package the Internet like you would get packages for cable. When you get cable, you get X amount of stations for X price. That's what they want to do with the Internet. And unless the groups out there fighting against this succeed, they're going to do it. So that will make it harder for people to listen to Media Monarchy online and to see the website. It'll be difficult. It'll be difficult to hear somebody like Alex Jones online, or to listen to other shows and see other sites online. This is what they want. And unless people stand up and fight them, they will get, eventually, what they want.
We just saw today that Twitter, the popular social networking site, was hit with a denial of service attack and was essentially down for a while. This, for me, kind of ties into this new, you know, social networking, and Twitter basically, of course, became, you know, a home known word during the Iranian elections, as it was sort of looked at. It was like, oh, you can use this as, you know, an activism kind of tool. For changes, I think, to happen to the Internet, we would almost need some sort of catastrophic and catalyzing event that would be a massive attack that would give them the political capital, an I-9-11, if you will.
An I-9-11. Yes. What you see with Twitter is that this service is being used as a sort of political weapon. It's being used as a weapon. In the case of Iran, this was used as a weapon.
We know that the Pentagon talked to Twitter and said, don't cut service in Iran. We you know, this is a needed thing.
Right. The so-called Iranian revolution is nonsense. I mean, people who really think that Mousavi, hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, won this election are out of their minds. It was very clear that Ahmadinejad won the election there. I mean, if you take a look at the state of the Iranian election machinery, I mean, it's not like the U.S. where you can easily rig an election. You know, if you've got black box voting, if you've got Diebold machines, and you know how to rig them properly, you can throw an election to anybody. I mean, that was basically what was happening. People don't want to talk about it, but that was basically what was happening. And of course, we had two so-called presidential elections in 2000 and 2004 that were won by Dan Rather's best friend, George W. Bush. So when it comes to Twitter, I like Twitter personally. But the question is Twitter being used as a political weapon? In the case of Iran, I believe that's absolutely correct. Oh, now, the reasons for Twitter being down more recently, I don't know. I know that it's up on your site, a story about that, and that's interesting. Because I do like Twitter, but, you know, it's something that needs to be looked at. You know, people have to keep an eye on certain elements of the Internet, especially the corporate elements, right? We saw that with the YouTube situation, right? The YouTube got taken over. They were throwing people like Alex Jones off of getting rid of his channel. Mm-hmm. It took hundreds of people. It took massive, basically emails and protests for them to restore it, you know. But see, that's what's happening. See, that's the slow takeover. I wouldn't say the takeover of the internet, because a lot of these corporate entities have the servers. They have the capacity. They have the phone lines. But what we're seeing is the slow process of intimidation, of consolidation, of amalgamation that's going on in regards to the internet. It's slowly happening. And I guess Twitter is one aspect of that, and the use of the internet as a weapon, in this case, most likely by the U.S. government.
And this ties in directly with newspapers shutting down and the general crisis that, you know, that we've already talked about.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I'll be going into detail about that, the general crisis of journalism, and laying out what I call the troika, my three points of analysis. But I did want to mention something about probably the most moronic political issue ever to emerge in my lifetime, which is the birther issue.
I made the dramatic noise that now we're the birthers.
As I like to call them, the afterbirthers, because this already came up during the election, right? It came up during the election last year, and it failed. So they bring it back up. So these aren't birthers, they're afterbirthers. I don't know what PR firm or what pollster came up with that term, birther, but it's interesting. So these are the afterbirthers.
I do find it amusing. It's a play on truther. It's a play on 9/11 truthers. So the term birther popped up.
Right.
And again, it's used to just sort of conflate people who have questions about 9/11. You call them truthers or birthers or crazies.
Right.
So break it down.
After birthers is what I call them. They're part of what I call the PPAC. That's the Placenta Political Action Committee. And their intent, as everyone knows, is to prove that Barack Obama was born in Kenya or Ghana or Tanzania or somewhere outside of the U.S., right? Now, on your site, you have an interview with Orly Tate, or as I like to call her, Oily Shakes, because every time she gets on TV, she shakes with a crazy fury.
The clip that is up there with her, the one video that I believe I do have up with her on MSNBC, you listen to this for just a minute. Is this someone you find even remotely credible?
No, I find her incredible. She's more incredible than the Hulk. She's the so-called leader of the birther movement. Now, it's interesting because Phil Berg, who is a Democrat, was one of the earliest people to come out with this story to hop on the issue of the birth certificate. But it's taken over by this, what's the term, technical term, lunatic, yes. This lunatic, Orly Tate, my apologies. And you see her in this interview. Go ahead and check it out on the site yourself, folks. And this is a woman. The first thing that she says is, I hope that you're going to treat me better than you treated CNN. How much time do I have? I've been doing talk shows this summer, radio talk shows and podcasts. And let me tell you something. When you go on a show, even if it's TV, the first thing you don't say is, how much time do I have? This woman is an idiot. I mean, the fact that she's taken seriously, probably she's taking something intravenously. That's what I think she's doing. The fact that this woman is being interviewed at all is endemic of what the hypocrisy of the mainstream media, and this gets into my criticism of the mainstream media and the crisis of the mainstream media, of journalism. When you look at those reporters afterwards, they're like, you know, holding their noses like, oh, yes, this is the birther movement. But we had to cover this because people want to know when they're interested in it. No. You're covering this because your bosses, your editors, your executives chose to cover this story. You could have said no to the birther issue. And I'm talking to MSNBC, CNN, Fox News. I'm talking to ABC, CBS, NBC. I'm talking to all the big major outlets, you know, even newspapers. You guys have chosen to cover the story. You could have ignored it. You could have said it's invalid. It's irrelevant. You chose to cover it. This is part of the endemic hypocrisy of the mainstream media. They want to hold their nose in one hand and yet somehow get dog feces on the other and start throwing it. You know, they don't have a problem with this. It's criticism slash coverage. That's what they like to do. It's rank hypocrisy. That's what I call it. And the whole birther issue is just not serious. Let's just ask some questions about this issue. Let's get some logical questions here. Why is this woman, Orly Tate, why is she filing suits in U.S. courts when these two birth certificates that have emerged, the, quote, Kenyan birth certificates, are not U.S. documents, they're foreign documents? Shouldn't the government of Kenya decide whether these are certified birth certificates or not? Not the U.S. government. These aren't U.S. birth certificates. Also, why is she the so-called leader of the birther movement? Who is this woman? She has U.S.-Israeli citizenship, supposedly dual citizenship. Why is this woman the head of the movement? Your comments on your site, I think, are hitting near the target of this. This woman is a shill. She is, basically, the Republicans are outsourcing their they're basically outsourcing their dirty tricks to insane people now. That's what's happening with this. And the very fact that this is considered a major issue by the mainstream media is part of their rank hypocrisy. Now, again, I looked at the issue of the fact that this was, she's filing suit in U.S. courts about quote-unquote documents which are foreign. They're supposedly Kenyan. Also, the very fact that she is basically her insinuations, when you take a look at this issue, these documents are pretty much phony. They're fakes. I mean, I know some people will dispute that, but they are. I mean, how many people have more than one birth certificate? Do you have more than one birth certificate, James?
Not to my knowledge.
Neither do I. I may have more than one copy, but I do not have more than one birth certificate. Also, it's an irrelevant political issue. Even if you were to prove that Obama is not the president and not born in this country, there's no way the Democrats will allow him to be removed as president. They have a filibuster-proof majority in the U.S. Senate. They also have a majority in the U.S. House. They're not going to allow it to happen. It's not going to happen. I don't care what Lou Dobbs or Orly Tate or anyone else says. They're on the wrong train heading to oblivion on this issue. And Lou Dobbs, as typical, is playing both sides against the middle. He brings this up on his show, which helped spark this up again. The fact he said, oh, the original birth certificate was destroyed. And then he wants to say, no, I'm not saying that Obama was born in another country. I believe he was born in the U.S. Come on. Again, hypocrisy slash coverage. I mean, I'm sorry. Well, coverage is hypocritical, but it's criticism slash coverage, right? The rank hypocrisy.
Absolutely.
That's right.
And they can cover themselves by saying, well, no, we're just covering this because people are interested in it, but they're interested in it because they keep covering it, but they can give the snide comments that distance themselves from saying, well, we're not actually, you know, playing into this. We're just kind of talking about it.
Here's another thought. I've been a journalist for 14 years, and if the mainstream media wanted to cover this story seriously, they're not covering it seriously. And keep in mind, I live in Hawaii. I've had people urge me to investigate this.
You're at the scene.
Yeah, I've been urged to investigate this. I won't touch it because I know it's BS. Here's what you do if you're a real journalist like me. If you have the resources, what you do is this. And I'll lay this out for people, and I don't know if this soundbite will make any news, you know, but it'll be interesting to have a lot of people listen to this and learn. What you do is you send a reporter to Kenya so he can look through their records to see if there's an actual birth certificate. You might also want to send somebody to England to look at the colonial office because Kenya was a British colonial possession in 1961 when Obama was born. You might want to look at that. And here's another simple aspect to this. If you believe that Obama was born in another country, you have to prove that his parents, his father and his mother, left Hawaii, left the U.S. in 1961. Why isn't anybody looking to what was INS records? What was INS? Why isn't anyone looking into those records? After all, Obama's father was a student. He wasn't a citizen of the U.S. He was basically an English subject because he was born and raised in Kenya. Why is anyone looking at INS? Don't you think it'd be easy to prove, or perhaps not so easy to prove, but it should be worth trying to prove that his parents left the country? If you can't prove that his parents left the country in 1961, in the summer of 1961, and landed in Kenya, Ghana, Tanzania, or wherever in Africa, then how can you prove anything about this whole birther issue? These are all logical steps that have not been taken by any of the mainstream media. You know why? They don't really want to investigate this issue. They want to cover it. They don't want to investigate it. They're rank hypocrites. They're gold-plated hypocrites. That's what they are. So I'm sick and tired of these people complaining about how what a terrible story this is and how bad it is when they don't have any problem putting it on TV, putting psychotics like Orly Tates. The only way she should be on TV is if she does a commercial for a drug company. You know, she should be in some field of poppies and flowers trying to decide if Zoloft is right for her. I mean, this is just absolute nonsense. And the fact that these major outlets, MSNBC, CNN, Fox, ABC, NBC, CBS, still cover this story, even Lou Dobbs, you know. In fact, when we talk about outsourcing, maybe we should outsource him to Mexico, see how he likes it.
For me, the scariest thing about all of this is that it ties into the race politics and class war and possible race war. And it seems to me that this is what the controlled corporate media kind of plays in. Their whole kind of agenda is to get us to fight amongst each other, whether we're black or white or Mexican or Arab or Jew or what have you. And so when we talk about the birther issue, I've compared it a lot to the focus of, you know, 9/11 research. For the most part, people talk about the controlled demolitions. But that, to me, is the similar kind of situation. It's a speculative thing that isn't getting to the heart of what's going on. As long as they can get us to ask the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about what the answers are.
It's fascinating you bring that up, because notice that the birther issue is given premium coverage, that they're given spotlighted coverage. And this issue is moronic and crazy, for the most part. But somehow, when it comes to the 9/11 truth movement, anytime they bring it up, guess what? The people who believe that, now I'm not a 9/11 truther. I'm not a person who believes the 9/11 was an inside job. However, I don't believe the official story, which is nonsense. But notice that whenever the 9/11 truth movement is brought up, guess what happens? These people are insane. They're lunatics. They're crazy. The contextualization is that these people are out of the mainstream. They're out of the fringe. If you ever see a Alex Jones or Webster Tarpley on CNN or any other network or any other channel, they're derided. These people are seen as absolute scum. For what? Because they don't agree with the official story? Because they don't agree that 9/11 with the 9/11 omission report? Anyone with a brain cell can tell that that report is just absolute nonsense. And again, I'm not a 9/11 truther. I'm not somebody who believes that 9/11 was an inside job. But I don't believe that crock of nonsense either. So it's interesting the way the 9/11 truth movement is derided, how they're treated like absolute scum. What have these people done? What has We Are Change? What have We Are Change and the different We Are Change groups done to deserve this? What have they done? These are people that have stated from the very beginning that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are wrong. And they said that people who are innocent are being killed needlessly. Have both parties done that? Have Democrats and Republicans done that? They've done nothing. They've done absolutely nothing while thousands of people and millions of people have been killed.
You're absolutely right, and I'm really glad to hear you say that. And that is that really, for me, ties into they can cover and of course, have on the crazies. Now, some would say, well, you know, they have Alex Jones on, and he's a crazy, too. But when guys like Tarpley or Jones, and of course, those days now seem to be over, but when they did get airtime on the regular talking head shows, they were poised. They knew they weren't going to have much time, but they didn't start their interview saying, well, how much time are you going to give me? They present a much more cogent argument, and I think a lot of times that's you don't want those guys on TV.
Yeah, they present intelligent arguments. If you've seen the Obama section, interestingly to note that there was nothing said about the issue of the birthers,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's what made it easier for me to hand out some copies of the Obama deception,
right.
Because if there
right.
were birther things in there, I honestly probably wouldn't have done it.
Notice that Jones' dissection of the Obama deception is on aspects that are feasible, logical, and rational. The mainstream media can't handle that. Even no matter what your position on Obama is, it doesn't matter. He doesn't deal with all the crazy issues like the birthers and this nonsense. Not in that film. But again, we see the rank hypocrisy of the mainstream media. And people wonder, well, why are you so critical of the mainstream media? This is one issue. What has the 9/11 movement done to deserve their being called racists, being called insane, being called liars?
Nothing but being very persistent. And anything
precisely.
That goes on too long in the media stage, and that is another ploy, I think, people get sick of it. I'm sick of those whatever it is this week. And they turn the channel, and they're off to caring about something else.
Right, right, right. Again, the way these people, the 9/11 truthers, have been treated, and you contrast this with how the birthers have been treated. Oh, they're crazy, but not as crazy as the 9/11 people. And notice they're treated with a lot more respect than the 9/11 truth movement, right? You know why? Because these birthers are less of a threat than the 9/11 truth people. The 9/11 truth people are not just talking about 9/11. They're critiquing the state of American government. They're critiquing the state of the American media. That's why they're dangerous.
That's absolutely right. And it ultimately, I think, shows that, you know, a real anti-war on terror stance is, in a sense, a 9/11 truth stance. But we're not
right.
seeing that in the main line, you know, and where is the anti-war movement now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Notice when Obama got in, these people clammed up. Well, they're not criticizing the war in Afghanistan.
No.
The war in Iraq.
No.
Yeah. Even though Obama sent more people to Afghanistan, they're not saying anything. What happened, guys? What, cat got your tongue? Or is it the alternative media's got your tongue? Or mainstream media's got your tongue? I wonder.
So that brings us back around, because we've been on the truther and birther subject. But let's get back to essentially, and what your points
right.
are on the crisis.
So let's get to the crisis of journalism. What is the crisis of journalism? It's the crisis that's affecting the state of the journalistic profession today. And I basically look at it in three component points. As I explained earlier, this is a crisis. I got the title from the Samuel Huntington white paper that was written in 1975. We also have the line that I use, borrowed slightly from Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine. I call this disaster journalism. There are three components: economics, technology, and news standards, or standards of news. Economics primarily deal with the crisis that's ongoing, the current fiscal crisis, whether you believe that it was caused by the subprime housing market or derivatives. In any event, there's been a crisis that has primarily impacted newspapers, because newspapers, like television and radio, they all, when it comes to news operations, are all capital-intensive operations. Newspapers especially, because you have staff members, you have a couple hundred journalists probably per newspaper, per daily newspaper, and you've got other support staff, and you've also got to get the news out, not just buying large rolls of paper and having a physical plant, but also being able to produce the news and getting that out. So that's what you have. You have this capacity that you have to have in order to get out the news. So that's where the lack of money comes in, lack of capital. Now, you combine this with the need for capital, the need for financing, or not so much financing, but the need for constant funds, with the resultant downturn in the advertising that, you know, the advertising that newspapers need. You also couple this with the fact that there's also the current fiscal crisis, lack of money in the credit markets. And that has led to the downturn. It's led to papers such as the Rocky Mountain News basically going bankrupt, going out of existence. And also it leads to the transfer of newspapers going from actual hard copy to text. And that gets into the second point, which is the technological point. And the technological point, what you have with the aspect of the technology is primarily the internet. Again, this primarily affects newspapers. It affects TV and radio as well, because with TV, what was formerly video can be seen as video on the web, but also as text, because you have the actual text of the story that's also on the website, which is interesting. It's kind of the reverse. But what you have with newspapers is what used to be hard copy is now text on screen. What used to be the world of paper is now the digital world. So it is almost as if there has been this metamorphosis that has occurred. It's almost like something out of Star Trek. That's the metaphor that I use. You know, like the Borg. You know, what do the Borg do in the Star Trek movies and in Star Trek The Next Generation?
Assimilation.
Right. They are a inorganic state fusing with an organic state, a human or other sentient being with metallic, robotic, computerized form. And that's what you see with newspapers. They've become sort of like the Borg, in a sense. You know, granted, that may be a metaphor or a comparison that people may not get. But
No. I love it. I mean, was just sitting here smiling because that's a lot of, you know, the way I think I look at things is through media comparisons and criticisms. And that, I think, explains it to people more. Because when you tell them, like, a TV show, they go, oh, I get it now.
Right, right. So I try to use some popular examples. I try to. So what we see is this transference to the internet. And so what the internet has become is not just complementary, but competitive. It is not just constructive, but destructive. Because it changes the sense of what existed. If you're the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, you're no longer hard copy. You're text on screen. You're just a website. So that's very different. And it reduces what we consider a newspaper to be. You know, it's a transformative occurrence. So we can see the role of technology. This is a greater technological change than the influx of the typewriter and the computer to newsrooms. Because the typewriter and computers did not destroy the very structure of the newspaper. But what we're seeing is the change in the business model. The old business model of the newspaper, having a couple hundred reporters, having a staff, having a newspaper that would be hard copy printed on a physical plant in a press and sent out to people, thousands of copies for a daily, every day. It's gone. It's dead. Even though it still exists, it's still dead. The final point that I want to get into is perhaps the most important point, and that is the news standards, or standards of news. And let me just offer my own definition of news. And here it is. News is what editors and executives say is important. Added to that is the idea that news is profitable. It's a product. A lot of people may disagree with this point, but let's be honest. Let's be frank. News is a product. Anytime you see MSNBC, CNN, or Fox, they're not giving you information. They're giving you a product. It's news that has been shaped, that has been filtered, that has been contextualized according to the institutional models that are inherent in a specific organization. That is what you have to understand. People understand this perhaps in a gut way, but not necessarily in an intellectual way. So what I use in regards to dealing with news and in comparative ways is what I call the fairness doctrine model and the ideological model. What is the fairness doctrine model? Well, as people may be aware, some people who follow the news business may be aware, the Fairness Doctrine model is an FCC regulation or law dating from 1949, I believe, that basically states if you have someone on a television news show, and it basically pertains to TV and radio, that the FCC, as per the Federal Communications Act of 1934, allows for this commission to oversee television and radio, not newspapers. They're not covered. So basically what the Fairness Doctrine had allowed for from about 1949 to when it was enacted, when it was revoked in 1987, it allowed for differing points of view to be on television and radio, but they had to be complementary or confrontational. In other words, they had to be complementary in the sense that you had to have liberal and conservative on a certain issue. You had to have a pro and a con side. You couldn't just have the pro side on and then have and then not feature the con side. They didn't necessarily have to be on at the same time, but they had to be on some broadcast. They had to show their point of view. So therefore, the journalist, in a television or radio sense, is like an arbiter. It's like a referee. They aren't the focus. They aren't the emanating point of this point of view. They are the people who stand between them. I've used the term stand like a colossus, but how many news reporters or anchors are colossuses anymore? None of them. So that's what you have with what I call the Fairness Doctrine model. No. Then you have what has developed is the ideological model, and that developed with the formation of Fox News in the mid-90s. But before we get into that, we have to see what happened with news. The news business deteriorated. It deteriorated from what I would call, also another word for the Fairness Doctrine model would be sort of the consensus function of news. What you saw, for example, at CBS in the 50s through the early 80s with Walter Cronkite is the Fairness Doctrine model in motion. That's what you saw. And it was evident in the networks, whether it was Chet Huntley and David Brinkley at ABC at NBC or anyone else at ABC. That's what you saw on the networks. You saw the Fairness Doctrine model in action as a model for the dissemination of news, for the informational content of news, for dealing with various types of issues and events. That began to change because the corporate model began to change. In the mid-80s, you saw Lawrence Tisch take over CBS. And with that came layoffs, cutbacks, and changes in the structure of CBS News, once the darling of the television news world, the standard, the gold standard of news. You saw that begin to erode under Lawrence Tisch. You saw that begin to erode in the 80s. Conversely, also at CBS, what you saw was the rise of a particular program, I'm sure that everyone has heard of, 60 Minutes. What 60 Minutes did is helped make news profitable. It took about 7 seasons for 60 Minutes to become a hit show, but once it did, it became one of the most successful shows probably in the history of television. It's still on the air after 30 years.
That's what I was going to say, still running to this day.
Right, because it is basically the magazine show that could, did, and continues to. It continues to make money. It's probably one of the most profitable shows ever made. Far more profitable than Seinfeld, for example, or any of the other major shows that are out there. And that is because they proved that news could be profitable. To a certain extent, you could say it's entertaining, but it's not entertaining in the degraded sense that news has become. It's entertaining in its setup, the use of editing, the use of ambush interviewing, the use of a sort of confrontational modus operandi, the idea of the underdog, the cliched underdog versus the giant or whoever it is they're interviewing. You know, Mike Wallace goes after his man. Mike Wallace is nothing but a phony. That's what he is. He's an entertainer. Before he did 60 Minutes, he was he did a show called Nightbee where he's an interviewer. But he also was doing game shows and doing commercials. Basically, he's an entertainer. So Mike Wallace is nothing but a phony. He's one of the... I can barely bring myself to say it. I'll give you an example. This was in the early 80s where he did a story about insurance. And this is what Mike Wallace said. And I dare anyone to argue with me about this. This is what he said. He said during the taping of a show, he said, Blacks and Hispanics were too busy eating watermelons and eating tacos to read their insurance policies. He got reprimanded for saying that, but nothing really happened. You know, he apologized and it blew over. Not only to mention the fact that Mike Wallace also taped a reporter who they wanted to appear on 60 Minutes. They secretly taped her in the hopes that she would change her mind once she heard the tape. They put like a hidden microphone in the drapes of the office. So Mike Wallace is not the model of investigative journalism and probity. You know, he's a suspicious character. He's essentially a cheap entertainer. That's what Mike Wallace is. But, you know, you see 60 Minutes as the standard, the gold standard, you know, as the prophet, as seeing news as profit. What 60 Minutes introduced was the sense that news could be a profit center. You got to understand that prior to the onslaught of 60 Minutes and the onslaught of what news has become now, news was considered public service. In fact, it helped fulfill the public service requirements that the FCC had for television and radio stations. So now, instead of being a loss leader, which is what a lot of network news stations, local newscasts, and a lot of network news was prior to, I'd say, the 80s and the 90s, and even now, it is now a profit center. Perhaps not as much a profit center as they'd like, but it's considered a profit center, or considered to be a profit mechanism for the network. Actually, a greater profit center would be the network news shows. Like Today, Good Morning America, and the early shows. Those are gold mines for the network.
The dailies.
That's where big money is. Yeah, that's a gold mine for the network. Absolute gold mine for the networks. So that's just very important for the network. In fact, it serves as the minor league. Where did Katie Couric come from?
She did a morning show, didn't she?
The Today Show.
Today, yeah.
Now she's the anchor at CBS, right? Brian Williams, who was on NBC, did some time on the Today Show. He wasn't the host. Now, the drawback with morning shows is, one, they're stupid. Let's be honest.
They also have people holding signs outside the windows, and
right.
It's a kind of a spectacle.
But they also have talented reporters. Like, the best interviewer on TV right now, I believe, one of the best interviewers is Matt Lauer on the Today Show. He's a very good interviewer. Granted, he's on the Today Show, which is probably the only decent morning show on. I don't like to watch morning shows. But he's probably one of the most talented interviewers, one of the talented reporters out there on TV, in the network TV world. This is a guy who should be anchor, quite frankly. The fact that Katie Couric is an anchor is a mistake. She's a good reporter, she's a very good interviewer, but she just doesn't have the chops when it comes to network news anchoring.
This, for me, all kind of brings to mind the film Network. And also the film The Insider, which is about CBS News.
Yeah, 60 Minutes. Shows the gutlessness on the part of 60 Minutes. The fact that you had the Jeffrey Weigand issue with Brown and Williamson. They did a piece on Weigand, basically a whistleblower for Brown and Williamson, dealing with the addictive qualities within cigarettes. They didn't run that story originally. And I have a copy of The Insider here at home. I think it's a very good movie.
It's one of my favorites. I actually, as we're sidebar here, I recently, to beat the sweltering heat here in Portland last week, went to go see Public Enemies, the Johnny Depp film about John Dillinger. And that's by the same director.
Right,
and I thought
Michael
it was
Mann.
Very disappointing. And I found myself pointing back to The Insider saying, now that's my favorite of his.
Yeah, that I would say is probably one of the finer films about American journalism I've seen in the past several years.
Absolutely. And just from, I mean, even and then including the cinematography and the score and the whole package.
Well, Mann is a first-rate filmmaker. I haven't seen Public Enemy. I've heard it's a big disappointment. And it's interesting, I'll eventually get to see it because I don't know what it is about John Dillinger. I have to see a John Dillinger movie. I've seen a whole bunch of them. I mean, anything with John Dillinger in it, I got to see. I don't know what.
I saw several months ago, I think, what is the first Dillinger film, and the exact year escapes me, though, but it stars the late Lawrence Tierney as John Dillinger. He's probably more known to people my age as the gruff crime boss in Reservoir Dogs.
Reservoir Dogs. Yeah, absolutely. A Tarantino. A Tarantino has a film that's coming out, Inglourious Basterds, which interested in.
Well, that's right. And we haven't seen that yet.
See how the connections are all there?
Well, and again, for me, I think I see, you know, going back to Katie Couric, mm-hmm. I sometimes wonder about these prominent talking heads, and they always generally seem to be kind of tied into what I see Katie Couric as being from the Council on Foreign Relations. And we see Walter Cronkite, which, of course, with his recent passing, there was a lot of other things, again, in the alternative media about him and his possible connections to what's called Operation Mockingbird and CIA and media.
Right. See, that's why when you take a look at these corporate anchors, they're the face of the networks, in a sense, in regards to news. And like any other aspect of corporate-owned media, and of corporate-owned news, which I like to call what I call con, they have to abide by the rules of their corporate masters, right? So that's very important. And getting back to the idea of the profitability, the idea, as I mentioned, with 60 Minutes showcasing the idea of the profit center, the news as profit center, news became a more attractive business model as a profitable operation rather than a loss leader. So what you see are changes, as I said, Lawrence Tisch at CBS in the mid-80s, cutting out personnel, cutbacks, cutting out bureaus. And you see the news becoming more and more tabloid-esque. You have the infusion of tabloid television coming in the 90s. And this, and you also, another important factor is what I would call the panel shows. That's very important too, panel shows. Because you see shows, first of all, the creation of CNN and the debut of CNN, but you also have panel shows like Crossfire, you have panel shows like
Hardball,
Hardball, that were being created, that are coming in, that showcase journalists who are talking about news from a point of view. They're not just talking about events. They're not just talking about news. They're contextualizing it. They're offering their views and opinions. So by the time the mid-90s come and we see the emergence of Fox News and Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes create this news network, there finally emerges what I call the ideological model. And the ideological model basically leaves the fairness doctrine model in the dust. The contextualization is through a single point of view, a unitary point of view, where you have a right-wing, in this case, point of view. So the anchors, the reporters, are embodying a point of view instead of standing between points of view. They are not reaching consensus. They're trying to reach a solid unitary series of talking points. The news doesn't become about information. It becomes about a series of arguments and talking points. You have panel shows like The O'Reilly Factor, you have Sean Hannity, you have Glenn Beck. So you have more panel shows than real news programs. You have basically what I call faux news instead of real news. You have talking points instead of headlines and leads and other parts.
It has the air to me of being like some kind of professional wrestling. Some kind of stage thing, because, you know, if you ever have had the misfortune of seeing wrestling, there are the parts where the guys get on the microphones and they talk a bunch of garbage about the other guy.
Right. Yeah, it's what I call news entertainment.
That's it.
That's what Fox News is. So news entertainment. See, what wrestling has done is at least they've tried to be honest. You know, they were called fake years ago, but what they call themselves is sports entertainment. What I call Fox News is news entertainment. Because it's not real news, it's news entertainment. If you watch The O'Reilly Factor, you're not watching a newscast. You're watching a former journalist, who's a pretty good journalist. Hurts me to say that, but it's true. Who's giving his view. He's filtering everything through his point of view, and as you can see from his one of his segments, his talking points, right? That's what The O'Reilly Factor is about. That's what Fox News is about. It's I guess that you could say it's the professional wrestling of the news world. But the news world has become more like professional wrestling than journalism anyway. That's what's happened. So we see that the ideological model has taken place and supplanted the the fairness doctrine model, but it didn't come out of nowhere. You know, Ailes and Murdoch didn't just create this out of thin air. They created it from the vacuum, what was filling the vacuum, the rise of opinion, the rise of contextualizing news from a unitary or solitary point of view, or from points of differing points of view, the lack of consensus. So you see that in the rise of the ideological model. What you're seeing on MSNBC, for example, is kind of a mixed ideological model. You have Joe Scarborough, but you also have Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann, who are probably the sharpest tools in the shed. They're probably the two best news people on the air in terms of cable news. And I hate to say that.
I have to begrudgingly admit that as well. That they're not buffoons like we look at the Becks and the O'Reillys.
Right.
But that's what I think frustrates me even more, is because they do such good work and they're not fools by any stretch, when I see it still tying into the left and right scheme.
Mm-hmm. Right. But see, the problem is the right is so useless. They don't have anybody serious that's there. They don't have any real news people. They don't have any real valid news hosts. I mean, just take a look at the troika there on Fox News. You've got Bill O'Reilly, who used to be a journalist. You have Sean Hannity, basically a college dropout. You know, he's basically a radio guy. You know, he's got the looks for radio and the... and the opinions for television. And you got Glenn Beck, who's the biggest wimp on TV. That's what Glenn Beck is. I mean, this is a man who cries more than, what's her name? Baker's wife.
Tammy Faye.
Yeah, Tammy Faye. He cries more than Tammy Faye Baker. I mean, seriously, you know, Glenn, you need to grow a pair. That's what I think. You need to stop crying. That's what you need to do. I mean, I heard him on his radio show, like, scream for a woman to get off the phone. I don't know if this was the woman's voice or his voice. This is supposed to be real. These are supposed to be real men. I mean, O'Reilly, yeah, I can see him as a real man, but Glenn Beck, you got to be kidding me. This is conservatism. This is the cream of the conservatives. Let's just say I prefer to have my coffee black, two sugars. No cream for me, thank you. That's the problem. That's the problem that you have here with not just Fox News, but the whole right-wing news angle. It's not that I love the left or I think the left are so great, just that Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann are just so much smarter and sharper, funnier and effective. They have a brain in their head. That's the problem. It's not that I want to love them or like them, but I just go, these are rational people. I don't feel that way with the Fox News people. They should call themselves the Faux News Network.
I'm glad that Faux really did take off, that people refer to it as Faux, F-A-U-X instead of F-O-X.
Right. Yeah, you know, I love their motto, you know, we report, you decide. Really? I've decided. You're biased, okay? The judgment is in. You're guilty of being right-wing idiots. That's what you are.
Let me hit you with this. I have not posted this up to the website yet. I just saw this recently. This is an article from Robert Perry, and it's on consortiumnews.com. GE muzzles Olbermann about Fox. The emergence of liberal evening hosts on General Electric's MSNBC has been welcomed by Democrats and others on the American left as a counterweight to the right and center-right bias of much of the U.S. news media. But there's a difference between GE testing out whether this lineup will produce a ratings boost and actual independence in journalism. Basically, they cite a New York Times article from August 1st.
Right.
Describing how GE responded to corporate pressure from Fox News by having GE chairman Jeffrey Immelt strike a deal with Fox News boss Rupert Murdoch, a truce that muzzled MSNBC's Olbermann's criticism of his Fox rival Bill O'Reilly in exchange for O'Reilly muting his attacks on GE and MSNBC and Olbermann.
Right. See, I think what prompted that was the fact that I know that O'Reilly hates GE. He has a vendetta with GE. And we all know that Olbermann dislikes O'Reilly. So what this did was it probably stemmed both, you know, holes in the dike and prevented, you know, the whole wall from collapsing. See, it's both sides. You got to look at both sides, not just Olbermann. They're looking at it just from Olbermann's side. But you got to look at O'Reilly with the fact he didn't like GE. So they're probably telling him, look, shut up about GE and you Overman shut up about O'Reilly, trying to like be fair and balanced. Again, I've decided that's unfair and unbalanced. But it just shows the not the influence of the corporate paymasters, but the dominance of the corporate paymasters. Keep in mind what these reporters are. They are company men and women. And when the boss tells you to shut up, you shut up. That's the difference between Keith Olbermann, who I have a lot of respect for, and Bill O'Reilly, who I think it used to be a really good reporter, and me. See, I can say what I want, because I don't have GE telling me to shut up. And I don't have Fox News and Rupert Murdoch telling me to shut up. So that's the difference. They are slaves. I am free. I sort of see myself, in a sense, like the number six character in the show, The Prisoner, the old show, The Prisoner, which is going to be remade.
Oh.
I don't know what I feel about that.
Always with the remakes.
Oh, God.
That's a whole
But in
topic.
Any event, yeah, I'm scared about that. Though I like Ian McKellen, he's going to be in this remake of The Prisoner. My feeling is, though, as being an independent journalist for 14 years, somebody who's been outside of the mainstream, who's had to deal, and more recently, stand up against the mainstream, my feeling is that, kind of like number six, I say, I am not a number, I am a free man. And that's what separates me from Keith Olbermann and O'Reilly. Are numbers, I'm free man.
I think that gets us to, I think, where we wanted to maybe go with this conversation as to how if we've been discussing the crumbling of, you know, the old media, we're trying to position ourselves in a way that we're, you know, and I have the quote at the beginning of my shows from Jello Biafra that says, don't hate the media, become the media. So how can we shift from the crisis and emerge in this new, you know, hopefully, and again, just because the mainstream media may sometimes lie to you or lie by omission or misdirect or any of that doesn't necessarily mean that the alternative media is therefore right on everything. So I guess basically, what's the silver lining that we're trying to move for and look for?
You have the silver lining in your site, Media Monarchy. You are part of the solution. Media Monarchy isn't the solution all by itself, but you're part of the solution. You're part of the solution by getting out there and providing a forum where people can look at the news free from the right-wing and left-wing contextualizations, the phony right and the phony left. You're providing an outlet where people can look at these stories. They can go to clips. They can go to newspapers. They can go to magazine articles. And they can contextualize for themselves. Or they can use the contextualization you bring out. You're providing sites like Media Monarchy are providing the means for people to choose. That's very important. They have to choose the news for themselves. Before, we had choices, not too many. When I was a kid, there was the network news. If you didn't see the network news, you saw the local news. And if you didn't see the local news, maybe there was an all-news station you could turn to. And if you didn't listen to that, there was the newspaper. And if you didn't read the newspaper, maybe your neighbor knew something. That was it. Now we've got the internet, we've got newspapers, we've got TV, but we've got newspapers and TV and magazines online. It's a one-stop shop. Well, is the internet the solution to everything? No, there is no solution to everything. What the internet provides is the means for you to decide. See, part of being in a country like the U.S. is an informed citizenry. If the citizenry isn't informed, how can they make decisions? Well, they actually don't want you to make decisions. They want to watch while the people who make the big bucks, the corporations and the wealthy interest make decisions. That's what they want. They want you to be spectators, not participants. Now you are a participant because you send emails, you read websites, you read blogs, you may write a blog. This is what freedom is about. Not democracy. Freedom. The freedom to choose, but also to shape, to mold, to do what they do in the media. You have the choice. That's very important. Now, in a book called News Incorporated, which is Corporate Media Ownership and Its Threat to Democracy, a number of articles are mentioned in here. Yeah, Danny Schechter's essay on understanding media ethics. And there was a taped, basically, announcement or taped statement made by the one and only Subcomandante Marcos, who is a rebel leader in Mexico. And this is what he said. This is in January 1997. "The world of contemporary news is a world that exists for the VIPs, the very important people. Their everyday lives are what is important. If they get married, if they divorce, if they eat, what clothes they wear, what clothes they take off. These major movie stars and big politicians. But common people only appear for a moment, when they kill someone or when they die. For the communications giants, the others, the excluded, only exist when they are dead, when they are in jail, when or in court. This cannot go on. So what is the choice?" He says, as Schechter brings out, his recommendation was to become the media, to create independent media to take on the big guns. "The problem is not only to know what is occurring in the world," this is his words, "but to understand it and to derive lessons from it, just as if we were studying history, a history not of the past, but a history of what is happening at any given moment in whatever part of the world. This is the way to learn who we are, what it is we want, who we can be, and what we can do or not do. By not having to answer to the monster media monopolies, the independent media has a life work, a political project and promise, purpose, to let the truth be known." There, and he also mentioned that there's a third option, is neither conforming nor skepticism nor distrust. That is to construct a different way, to show the world what is really happening, to have a critical worldview and to become interested in the truth of what happens to the people who inhabit every corner of this world. That is what is happening on the internet. It's happening with websites like yours. It happens with people, whether they're 9/11 truth activists or not, whether they're conspiracy theorists or not, whether they are people who love freedom or not. These are the sites, these are the blogs, these are the locations for people who are resisting the tyranny of the corporate-owned news, of the mass media, of the major media, of the mainstream media. You know, one of the things I like to say on radio shows and on podcasts is a quote from the new Terminator movie. If you're listening to this, you are the resistance. That's very important. You are the resistance. You know, it's important that we have choices. Before, we had very few choices. Now we have many choices. And what's important is that not only that you continue to exercise these choices, regardless of what it is. It could be the kookiest news available. It could be kookynews.com or crazynews.com. It doesn't matter. You have the choice to contextualize. You are your own newspaper, in a sense. You are your own radio station, your own TV. That is what these websites do, and that's what you, as a consumer of the internet, in a sense, somebody who pervades, peruses these websites, can do. It's very important that people continue to exercise these choices. And that is what the new alternative media is doing through its websites, through its blogs, through showcasing clips, articles, magazine articles, newspaper articles, through showing documents, through providing an outlet, the alternative to the mainstream media. The mainstream media are having a hard time. They've been having a hard time for the past few years. Let me quote you from another book called Reality Show, Inside the Last Great Television News War by Howard Kurtz, who's a media critic with the Washington Post, or has been. Where there was once, this is from the introduction, where once there were just three alternatives for the day's national headlines, hundreds of thousands now beckoned, shiny and seductive. We were hurtling into an era of personalized news, of custom-tailored news, of opinionated news, of satiric news, of fact-free news, of skip the vegetables and have the ice cream news. If indeed anything resembling news was on the menu, younger people especially wanted what they wanted when they wanted it, whether it was radioed, video streamed, satellite, blogged, or podcasted their way. You know. And it goes on to talk about places like Howard 100 News on Sirius Radio Channel, Google News, Stephen Colbert, MySpace.com. The larger reality was that all of organized journalism was in deep trouble. And this is back to quoting Howard Kurtz. "As I was painfully aware after a professional lifetime in the trenches." So that is very important.
And that, this all, I think, really speaks to where we are right now, and perhaps the danger, in a way, of perhaps the dark side of it. I always kind of way like to even look at the language sometimes, that is this becoming, you know, yes, we can personalize the news, but is that what, is the moral relativism and whatever I choose to believe is what is true? And the, it's iTunes and MySpace, that it's this sort of new era of narcissism. I don't feel like I've fallen victim to that, but it's, I think, definitely a real thing.
Yeah, but people are finally being given the opportunity to choose the news that is right for them. If you're a right-winger and you want right-wing news, have your right-wing news. If you're a left-winger and you want left-wing news, have your left-wing news. But you have real choices. What we want are accuracy in those choices, right? I'm not for right-wing news or left-wing news. I'm for accuracy in news. That's what I care about as a reporter. That's what I care about as a journalist. What I care about as a writer. I'm not particularly interested in the phony right or phony left or the pseudo right or pseudo left. I'm interested in accuracy in media, whether it's the news media, whether it's the television media, the newspaper media, or the internet media. And conversant with what I was bringing out about standards of news is the rise in the entertainment media. You see Entertainment Tonight, you see Insider, you see Access Hollywood. I have nothing against those shows. They do a pretty professional job. But the worst of these contenders in the rise of the entertainment media, see, what they do is they've used the idea of celebrity as a categorization, not just of film stars and TV stars and music stars, but also politicians. Sarah Palin is not just the former governor of Alaska. She's a celebrity. Barack Obama isn't just the president of the United States. He's a celebrity.
I think it even goes to the point of the woman who had octuplets is a celebrity. And the woman who sang on the British Idol, she's now a celebrity.
Right. I was mentioning that on another show. Here's this poor woman who's thrust out into the public spotlight. And this woman, no wonder she had a breakdown and went to a clinic. I mean, who can take being hounded by the media? Who can take being seen as this celebrity? It's not fair for her, and it's not fair for us. And what it does is the bread and circuses effect. Because I can tell you, in England, if you're focused on Susan Boyle, you don't care anything about Jeffrey Brown. You don't care anything about what the Labour Party is doing. You don't care about the fact that probably the United Kingdom is broke financially as a government in terms of its in terms of the government. You don't care about other aspects, like whether Dr. David Kelly's death will be seriously looked into. You don't care about what's happening on a local level in England with your council and with Parliament on a larger national level. You don't care about all these other aspects. You care about Susan Boyle. Nothing against the lady, but she's simply not that important in the grand scheme of things. What's important is what's happening not just right in front of us, but what's happening in the secret corridors, what's happening in hushed tones, what's happening with people doing things that are not only illegal and unethical, but immoral. That's what's important. And unless the media is there to shine a spotlight on it, it's not going to get reported. That's where I talk about the entertainment media being the bread and circuses effect. And the worst contender of this is TMZ. They are just absolutely putrid.
And TMZ, this is essentially at the forefront of this new sort of, web-enabled tabloid journalism. And it's what?
Absolutely.
TMZ.com or?
Yeah, TMZ on TV. These people are nothing but scum. I've mentioned this on other shows, and I'm going to keep mentioning this. You know who should be on the unemployment line? Harvey Levin. That's who I think should be on the unemployment line. This is the managing editor. I mean, basically his career highlights are being the reporter on the People's Court, the guy who asked people outside what they thought about the...
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That was his gig?
Yeah. The People's Court.
Post-game interview, yeah.
the bastion of legal jurisprudence, of televised legal jurisprudence. This is a guy who should be on the unemployment line. He and his scumbag acolytes at TMZ, 30 Mile Zone, they are the worst. I hate to be in a position to support or defend Hollywood celebrities. I don't have anything against them. They're okay people, I guess, depending on what your view of them is. I have other things to worry about. But I've watched some of these episodes of TMZ, especially when I was in LA, I saw some of them. And I think TMZ has gone too far. They're one part stalker, one part private investigator, one part paparazzi. And brought together as an organic whole, they're garbage. You know, and this is, I'll say this on this show, I don't know if this would be a scoop, I don't think it's going to go anywhere, but this is what I would say to all these actors, these celebrities, these music stars that have been harassed, have been bothered, that have been intimidated by TMZ. Here's what I tell you guys. Fight them. Write to Time Warner. I think Warner Brothers is the entity behind TMZ. What you need to do is send emails. You need to get TMZ. I don't know if they're still on the air. I haven't seen the show in a long time, and I don't care to. But you need to send emails to Warner Brothers, to Time Warner, telling them to get this putrid garbage off the air. You need to use your celebrity. You need to use your power to fight back. You know, just because you're famous doesn't mean you can let people walk all over you. You can't, just because you're famous doesn't mean that they can get away with calling you every name in the book, with chasing after you, where you go to restaurants, whether you come out of, you know, hair salons or whatever you go. You individuals, whether it's George Clooney, Alec Baldwin, individuals who I know detest the media, this kind of media. No, they don't detest the media. They detest these gossip mongers, these scumbags. You guys have an opportunity. You have a power. It's the power of influence as celebrities. I would advise you to take advantage of that. Write to Time Warner. Write to Warner Brothers. Write to the individuals who are putting this putrid garbage on television. Tell them, take it off. Tell them, use your celebrity to fight these people. I don't care who it is. I mean, it could be, who are the people on the hills? I've never seen that show, but I've seen these.
Oh, are these recently the guys who came out and basically were talking about the microchip agenda and the New World Order? Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, I think Heidi and
Spencer. But yeah,
yeah,
I've never
it.
Seen him before.
Heidi and Spencer. I don't know who you are. I don't know what, why you're famous other than you're on some show called The Hills. Use your power. Go after TMZ. Fight them. That's what I have to say. Alec Baldwin, go ahead and do it. George Clooney, go ahead and do it. All of you celebrities out there in Hollywood, you have the opportunity. Use your power. They don't have the right to harass you. They don't have the right to intimidate you. I don't care how famous you are. I don't care whether you made millions of dollars. The public does not have a right to know every single detail about you. And TMZ has, their only agenda is to make you look bad, to humiliate you, to mock you, to put you down. Take these filthy pieces of disease-ridden garbage off the air. You have an opportunity. You can use it. I don't think anything is going to come of this, but you know, I mentioned TMZ on a couple of other shows. You got an opportunity. I support you all the way. Just do it. I don't care who it is.
I think that this really ties in, you know, with one, the industry that sort of, it keeps itself alive by building someone up to tear them down the next week.
Right.
But when we see, this is the thing with the tabloid journalism, they're most interested in the ridiculous and mundane of what they're wearing or not wearing. But when they come out and say something political or social, we switch around and say, well, I don't care what you have to say about that. You're just a celebrity. So if Charlie Sheen or Ventura or any of those guys are talking about 9/11 or Jim Carrey is talking about the vaccines, suddenly, I don't want to hear that.
I read Jim Carrey's article. I think it was on Huffington Post about vaccines. I thought it was a good article. Now, here's a guy who's made money talking out of his butt. That's understandable.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. But here he has something cogent and intelligent to say, and he's dismissed. Why? Because he's a comedian. Charlie Sheen is dismissed because he's on 2.5 Men. He's an actor. Oh, we can't listen to what he has to say about 9/11. Who cares if he has doubts about 9/11? Oh, maybe because 49% of New York residents, as indicated in a poll, said they have doubts about the official story of 9/11 and think the government was involved or knew something about 9/11? Are those people all insane? Tell me, are they all insane? No, but somehow Charlie Sheen is. See, when you're talking about real substantive stuff, and you could dismiss it all you want, but at least these people have the courage of their convictions to say, hey, I don't agree with this aspect. Whether it's a Jim Carrey who doesn't agree with what's happening with vaccines, and he has a reason to be, or a Charlie Sheen who doesn't agree with the 9/11 fantasy story cooked up. And again, I'm not a 9/11 truther, but I don't believe the official story. See, this is what's going on. You know, what they want are fluff from celebrities. They want them to sound serious when it's convenient for them to sound serious. But when they actually have something to say, you know, they're kind of like these people that go, sorry, I'm not hearing it. What did you say? No. That's crazy. See, it's very convenient for them. And so the TMZ phenomena, again, you know, feeds into this bread and circuses. That's part of what has been dragging the media down, this whole TMZ phenomenon. It's part of what's been dragging it down. We've had a culture of tabloid journalism in terms of the mainstream media since the early 90s. But TMZ is the basic nadir of it. It's the low sink. And at this point, I'm just so sick of it. It's got to go. So I'm telling you, those actors out there in Hollywood, any of these Hollywood personalities and stars, go to Time Warner, go to the people behind TMZ, and send those emails. Tell them, look, take this stuff off the air. They're following me at shopping centers. They're doing this kind of stuff and asking me inappropriate questions. We don't want this kind of filth on the air. And the people out there who support TMZ should be ashamed of themselves that they consistently watch this show. I don't even know if it's still on the air, but they should be ashamed of themselves. This is harassment. And this is harassment that's sanctioned by at this stage, it's sanctioned. It's basically allowed to continue. It's not right. Because if they're going to go after celebrities, guess what? They're going to go after you.
This gets to what, you know, that we have the power. Don't give them your money, to put it kind of simply. And there's even, you know, the bit in The Simpsons on the Halloween episode where all of the advertising icons come to life and start to smash the town. But the way that you beat those monsters is just don't look.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
remember.
Please continue.
So, yes, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I don't have any power when it comes to TMZ other than not to watch it. But I think this is just a low sink.
It's the race to the bottom, essentially.
Yeah, precisely.
It's the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, it's the lowest common denominator. And I'm tired of being denominated by these people with low IQs that run TMZ. Again, I think Harvey Levin should go on the unemployment line. That's my view of Harvey Levin. He and his, decrepit acolytes should be out there. They should be thrown out. TMZ is nothing but trash. They should be taken off the air if they're not already on off the air. Maybe they can be, you know, they'll still be on the internet, but, I don't have to go on their site. I've never been on their site and I don't intend to. So, again, I encourage all these Hollywood actors and TV stars, fight TMZ. Get it off the air. That's my recommendation. That's all I can say on that subject. Because I don't even want to talk to
So,
sick.
Well, as we, I think, start to wind it up here,
yeah.
What is, you know, one, some closing words of wisdom for folks, but two, a way and maybe a place for people to find your work or where, you know, you're best readable and watchable and locatable. Not
right.
Way, of course. But.
Well, I've been on a number of other talk shows this summer talking about my investigation last year of a wind company called First Wind. And so I've been talking about that, so you can go to some other shows. I don't know.
That's true. There are other things that we could have talked about other than.
Right. Oh, yeah. There's plenty that we could talk about.
There
this is plenty right now talking about my critique of the mainstream media. I mean, I've been a reporter for 14 years, and it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. But I'm always so proud because I did not sink to the low level, to the mud, to the filth, to the feces that other reporters have. I've never done trend stories. I've never done these kind of tabloid-oriented sex and violence stories. I haven't sunk into that level, you know. And as you can see in my bio, last year I covered the Obama victory at the Hawaii Democratic Caucus. I've done various types of stories. And strangely enough, I even covered a beauty pageant once, the Miss Universe pageant. You know, considering all the weird things that beauty pageant winners say, I'm thinking maybe I should try the Miss America pageant. Maybe a big story might be interesting there. I don't know.
But, well, that could be the source of whatever the next, you know, viral video that goes around.
Right. You know, it's funny. I never thought anything big would emerge from you. I did the Miss Universe pageant years ago, and I just thought it was a nice diversion, very fun, great-looking chicks.
Yeah, that's their worst assignments to get.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, that's a lot of fun. I can't go into details on the air, but it was a lot of fun. What I would have to say, of course, is we have alternatives. We have an alternative media. People will deride it as crazy and goofy and nonsensical, but that's up to you. It's up to you, the viewer, you, the internet surfer, you, the person who even is in charge of a site like Media Monarchy. It's for you to make those decisions. You know, we're at a point where people actually have real choices. We don't want these choices taken away. You know, the mainstream media dictate to you what the choices are so long as you watch their programs. Even people I like Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann, they have bosses. And their bosses may not tell them precisely what to do, but sometimes they put their foot down and tell them what they have to stop doing, as in Olbermann's case. What we have here is a true sense of freedom that exists on the web. Now, is everything going to be rational or logical or even sane in regards to websites and blogs and places to go? No, but that's your decision. You have the choice to go to the crazy website or the sane website. You have a choice to even write your own blog to complain. That's how Dan Rather got into trouble for his Bush story. Bloggers went out there and said, hey, this is nonsense. This is crazy. You have that choice. And you have that ability. Well, we want experienced, educated people to do this. We don't want guys in their underwear just writing blogs, you know. We want people who know what they're doing. But people have the opportunity now. This is a time when we have some real freedom here in regards to the news. And it's up to you, America, or Portland, Oregon, or wherever I'm heard. It's up to you to choose news sites and information sites like Media Monarchy and to bypass the corporate-owned junk and garbage that you see on CNN, MSNBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox. ABC, CBS, and NBC. That choice. Remember something. They're afraid of you. They're afraid of what you will think and that you will not think the way that they want you to think after they have contextualized the news stories they have given out to you. They're afraid of you. And so if you fight back and you respond by making certain choices, that will affect them. It won't change the structure of the news media as I have explained it and as I have critiqued it. But it makes them wary. It makes them on guard. And it makes them take notice. So keep on choosing. Keep on fighting. And more importantly, keep on coming to sites like Media Monarchy.
Man, I think that's it. And you said it earlier.
Yeah.
If you are listening to this, you are the resistance.
Fantastic. It's absolutely correct.
Man,
you are the resistance.
Thanks so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. I think this was really good. I enjoyed this.
I enjoyed it, too. This is probably, I've been doing other talk shows, and I've been doing other podcasts, and I had a lot of fun. I may have not supposed to say fun. It's supposed to be serious. It's supposed to be kind of work. But this has been a lot of fun. I've exercised a lot of feelings about the mainstream media that I've held in for years, and I've finally gotten the chance to bring it out and reach an audience, and I really appreciate it. I really appreciate doing this show and the podcast and everything. This has been just a lot of fun. Probably the best time I've had thus far.
All right, man.
I'd love to come back. It's just fantastic.
Absolutely. And there, I'm sure, all the other subjects that we can get into.
Right.
Albert Lanier, I really appreciate it, man.
I thank you.
I'll talk to you soon.
Yes, absolutely.
Take care.
Combining music and stylized images.
It's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
Say, I want my threat.
And that concludes our program for tonight.
Yo. This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.